Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What will future generations of geologists learn from the fossil record about humankind's impact on the planet? At the end of the Pleistocene era, scientists agree we entered the Holocene, but now a growing number of experts are exploring the possibility that the massive extinctions and geologic changes brought about by human industrialization have been enough to propel us into a new era named Anthropocene for the creatures that set all the change in motion. Journalist Elizabeth Colbert covers the story in the March issue of National Geographic magazine. Her article is called Age of Man, Enter the Anthropocene. Betsy, welcome back to Think.
Thanks for having me.
So scientists now believe we are living through a period potentially of extinction that rivals those caused by major meteor strikes. How is that possible?
Well, if you simply look at there's sort of two lines of analysis that people use, or maybe more, but I will just mention two. Mm-hmm. One is just literally looking at extinction rates, and one way that people have done this very meticulously, one of the problems you have looking with, you know, how extinction rates today is we don't even know how many organisms there are on a planet, how many species there are, so it's sort of hard to say, okay, what proportion of them are going have or are going extinct. But if you look at very well-studied groups, so we're pretty confident, for example, you know, that we know most of the existing bird species, most of the existing mammal species, and people have looked at, okay, if you look at the numbers that have gone extinct, if you look at the numbers that are moving from the category of, you know, threatened to endangered to critically endangered to, you know, barely hanging on to extinct, and then you can see that extinction rates are very, very much higher than what are called background rates. So background rates are sort of the rate you would expect to see in the absence of any kind of outside pressure in sort of what we call normal geological times. Mm-hmm. So people estimate that extinction rates today for most groups of organisms are 100 to 1,000 times higher than they would normally be, and for some groups they're tens of thousands of times higher.
Wow.
And if you sustain that over any period of time, then most of the mass extinctions of the past, you know, did take, you know, quite a long time geologically, you know, from our perspective, not a long time geologically speaking, you know, let's say a million years or, you know, half a million years. So if you sustain these rates over those times, you see that you will lose, you know, a very significant proportion of the species on Earth. So that's one way that people look at it. And another way they look at it, which is sort of equally ominous, is they look at, okay, what are some of the drivers of the extinctions of the past as far as we can tell? And a lot of that is fairly mysterious. These are events that, you know, happened in some cases hundreds of millions of years ago. But we see that we're doing things like changing the atmosphere, you know, putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere at a rate that is probably faster, for example, than occurred in some major episodes of climate change in the past that did have serious consequences for the, you know, life on the planet. We're actually doing it faster than happens during some of those other episodes, and that also has implications for the oceans, because a lot of our carbon dioxide is ending up in the oceans, where it has the effect of acidifying the oceans. And all of these kind of markers that people look at, indices of geophysical change, it turns out that what we're doing, it seems to us very ordinary. That's just, you know, what modern life is. But if you look at it from the perspective of life on the planet over, you know, long, long periods of time, what we're doing actually turns out to be quite extraordinary.
And adding all that acid to the oceans, and it's happened before, causes something called a reef gap, where essentially the acid just dissolves corals and they cannot exist?
Well, I should say, and I don't want to get too technical, you know, we don't know what caused some of the reef gaps in the past. Mm-hmm. What has been noted is that after a major extinction event, of which, you know, let's say there's sometimes supposed to be five, you know, really major extinction events of the last half a billion years. The last was the event that, you know, that you alluded to, the asteroid strike, that whose effects led to the demise of the dinosaurs and the demise of the mosasaurs and the demise of the ammonoids, and many, many whole classes of organisms went out at that point. If you look at the fossil record from after that kind of an event, you see there aren't reefs, and reefs over history have been built by many different kinds of organisms that don't exist anymore. So in our era, you know, reefs are built by a kind of coral. In other eras, they've been built by other kinds of corals or by other kinds of organisms. But you just don't see them. So you infer from that, from many millions of years after these events, and you kind of infer from that that there must have been something that happened to ocean chemistry that made reef building impossible. And one possibility is the oceans in these events become acidified. The chemical balance changes so that organisms cannot accrete the kind of skeletons that you need for a reef.
So you mentioned the fact that throughout the Earth's history, there have been apparently 5 documentable cases of just mass extinction. And this is studied and sort of interpreted by a branch of geology called stratigraphy. Can you talk about that?
Well, yeah. There have actually been, you know, more than 5 mass extinctions, and mass extinctions are just sort of defined as moments. They don't have a very, you know, absolute definition, but just moments where these, you know, rates of extinction sort of skyrocket temporarily. So there have been more than 5, many more than 5 probably, but 5 of them, you know, really stand out. They're referred to as the Big 5, and they really stand out in the record as times, including one about 250 million years ago, when people say, you know, life itself seems to have come very close to sort of winking out a very high proportion of the species, the families of organisms on Earth disappeared at that moment. And how do we learn about these things? Well, you know, the only record we have is the record that comes down through the rocks, through the fossils left from that period. And one of the interesting, you know, sort of exercises about thinking, are we entering this new geological period, you know, the Anthropocene, is what will the record that we leave behind, what will that be? So that's sort of a thought experiment. We don't know what it will be. We have to try to think, what are the processes that are going on now that are going to be recorded in the rocks, you know, 10, 20, 30 million years from now.
And one really interesting remnant that we might leave behind is in cities.
Right. I mean, cities are, you know, very, very obvious to us, right? We see our cities. They're huge expanses of man-made material, or sometimes they have a lot of rock, but they've been transported, you know, from very far away. And so one of the questions you could ask is, okay, what will our cities look like, you know, millions of years from now? And one of the points that people make about that is that, you know, you have to really, once again, you have to think like a geologist. You have to realize that what is on above ground now, you know, often becomes will sink, will become either sedimented over or erode away. So a lot of cities are on coastal regions. They'll probably, you know, be underwater. And what will remain after, you know, millions of years of compressing them down into nothing? And the short answer is not much. You know, not much will remain of them in the geological record. But if you were a lucky geologist and you sort of hit on the record of on where, you know, Manhattan was, you would find some very interesting markers of that we were here.
You know, it's interesting when you talk about, you know, we feel like our cities are permanent, but we have not millions of years ago, but just thousands of years ago, evidence of cities that seem to have disappeared that are then unearthed in jungles, and we find these amazing societies. So it's not such a stretch, really, to imagine that what is Manhattan today will disappear at some point.
No, absolutely, you're right. I mean, you know, we as you point out, we constantly happen upon indeed, you know, whole civilizations that have disappeared. So absolutely.
What about the farming that we do? You quote the statistic, 38% of the land that's not covered with ice is used for agriculture today?
Well, we are leaving a huge, we've really transformed a tremendous proportion of the surface of this planet, right? The land that's not, you know, not underwater and it's not under ice. We are using a lot of that in one way or the other. And the biggie, as you mentioned, is agriculture. So either grazing land or actively plowed land. And that is also something that people think about when they think about what will, you know, the geological record of the future look like. What will these landscapes that we've transformed, how will that show up? Well, one way, interesting way that it will show up is you can actually go back over long, long expanses of time and find fossilized pollen.
Hmm.
And so our, you know, if you think about like the American Midwest, the pollen record from that sort of often gets collected like in lakes. You would do a lake core, go down through the bottom of a lake, try to go back as long as you can. So for a long time, it would be, you know, the upper Midwest was actually, you know, glaciated in the last ice age, and then you would get a pollen record of a prairie, you know, the prairie that of sort of prehistoric North America, and then you would get this kind of, you know, monoculture that we have now, or you know, it's not exactly a monoculture, you know, wheat, corn, the big crops that are grown in the American Midwest right now. So you would see, if you were somebody who, you know, understood how to read a pollen record, you would see a very dramatic shift.
And that would obviously be very different from natural forested land or land that had not been cultivated.
Right, absolutely. You would see, as opposed to many different plants. And as I say, people do this for not only to look at human disturbance of landscape, but really just to go back in time and say, okay, what was in the Amazon, you know, a couple million years ago? And you can get quite an interesting picture of the plant life that was in the area by going back that way. And you can see in some cases, you know, obviously naturally occurring changes in vegetation. And you would see, in our case, this weird, you know, replacement of a natural or just a varied landscape. You might not know what's natural and what's not natural, but a varied landscape going into this very, very uniform pollen record.
Would it be pretty easy to read in the future the time at which the planet's temperature started to rise?
Well, you know, temperature per se is not recorded in rocks, although it is recorded in ice. So if there's any ice left in the planet, I mean, one of the things people do when they drill ice cores in Antarctica and Greenland is that they have very clever ways of extracting a temperature. So that's almost sort of a thermometer. And the ice record in Antarctica goes back a very long time, hundreds of thousands of years. But the rock does not record temperature in a direct way or even really a very indirect way. So you have to try to infer what climate conditions were like by looking at, you know, very somewhat complicated records, looking at sea level records. That's been done very extensively for different periods of time, looking at what plant life looks like, looking, in fact, even you can try to extract what greenhouse gas levels were like in the atmosphere and infer from that. So there are all sorts of different ways, and people do have a pretty good idea of what the climate has looked like, you know, over a very long period of time now, but there are big error bars in there. You know, it's within a very wide range.
My guest is journalist Elizabeth Colbert. Her article in the March issue of National Geographic magazine is called Age of Man, Enter the Anthropocene. Join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Elizabeth Colbert. Her article in the March issue of National Geographic magazine is called Age of Man, Enter the Anthropocene. Join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Betsy, I was interested to read in the article that the idea of the Anthropocene era was actually proposed well over a century ago by a remarkably prescient Italian geologist. Why did no one pay attention to him at the time?
Well, it was sort of a, seen as kind of a, you know, way out there concept. And there are actually other people who have proposed this sort of we're entering. There's also a word that I think is pronounced newosphere. We're entering the age of thought. We're entering the age of man. And all those things at the time seemed a little bit, you know, sort of flaky, to be honest. And it's only really, really quite recently that the impacts have become, you know, so great. The scientists who are, you know, very, very conservative. I mean, I think it's important to understand that people, you know, geologists are used to looking at processes that, you know, unfold over millions of years. They don't take it lightly to, you know, enter a new geological, you know, epoch. And so the fact that geologists are considering this at this point, I think really is indicative of how very, very dramatic the impact that we're having on the planet is at this point.
I have to wonder, too, if when it was first proposed, the idea of the age of man was something that people would have celebrated rather than been very concerned about.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, in some of these you know, writings, it's exactly right. This is great. We're entering a new age. You know, we're entering an age where we control the world, or where thought controls the world. And so, yes, they were not sort of as nuts and bolts as people are thinking about now. You know, what are we really looking at in terms of, you know, the carbon isotope record or something like that. But also they weren't as gloomy as they are now. I mean, there's definitely the discussion of the Anthropocene is tinged with a lot of warning and trepidation. And the man who invented the term, who's a Nobel Prize-winning chemist, who won the Nobel Prize for being one of the people to figure out that human beings were, you know, effectively destroying the ozone layer. So that was incredibly important work to which we all owe a real tremendous debt, and led to the banning of a lot of ozone-depleting chemicals. He said to me, you know, I hope this is a wake-up call. I want this word to be a wake-up call to people. You know, because just because you, as many people have pointed out, just because you are controlling, you know, the fate of the planet, it doesn't necessarily mean you know what we're doing. And that's sort of the situation we're in now. We are in effect in the driver's seat here, but it's not entirely clear that we know how to operate the vehicle,
or that we have a map to where we're trying to go.
Right, exactly.
So tell the story about how Paul Crutzen, this chemist, actually coined the term. He was at a conference and essentially sort of stood up in disgust and said, we've got to stop calling this the Holocene era?
Right, exactly. He was in a conference of a, I think he said it was in Sweden. He himself is Dutch, and he works in Germany. And he said that the chairman of the conference kept referring to the Holocene, which is the official period we're in, which is an interesting geological period because it's a very short one. It's also sort of very human centric. It starts at its official date is about 11,500 years ago when the last ice age ended. It's a much shorter time span than other ones. So Pleistocene, you know, lasts a couple million years, and older periods last many millions of years. So, and he said, well, the way he describes it, he just sort of blurted it out. Let's be frank, we're not living in the Holocene anymore. We're living in a new age. We're living in the Anthropocene. And people were very struck by that. It sort of crystallized, I think. It's one of these things where things are vaguely floating around, and then they crystallize. And he then wrote a very short piece that appeared in Nature a couple years later, and the term really took off. And now you will find it, if you just plug it into the web, you'll find it everywhere. You'll find it in a lot of scientific journals. It's just very much out there.
Yeah, I did a quick Google search this morning, and there are 121,000 results for this term.
Yeah, it's really been embraced by the scientific community, and the question, the formal question before us, before geologists, really, there is a group, the Anthropocene Working Group, which is looking at the question of should we actually officially change the name of the era that we're in, so that when you look at, you know, those geology tables from, you know, high school or whatever, you would have a new era, it actually is called an epoch. It's not an era. There are different geological divisions of time.
Let's talk about when it is believed to have begun. Now, I understand that the differences in time in terms of when the epoch is supposed to have begun are small and infinitesimal in geologic terms, but there are some questions as to when we ought to label the beginning of this thing. Can you talk about that?
Sure. I mean, one of the questions is, once again, it's sort of a thought experiment, which is, okay, what... Let's go back and let's look at how we have traditionally looked at these boundaries between different periods. So sometimes they are marked by a fossil that disappears, a certain commonly fossilized organism, usually a marine creature. So one disappears or one comes in, one appears in the record. So there are all sorts of different ways that we have traditionally marked the boundaries between layers. Now there's a chemical marker at the end of the Cretaceous period, where we had a big meteor strike, and that left a layer of an element called iridium that's global, that global marker. So that is used to mark the end of the Cretaceous. So what would be a good marker for the beginning of this period? Now, one suggestion that's been made is that the first nuclear test in the 1940s left a pretty clear chemical nuclear signature all over the world. So that's one place you could potentially begin it. Other people say, well, really it started at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. If you look at carbon dioxide records, which are in ice cores now, you see that carbon dioxide levels start to go up right around 1800, and they begin this sort of relentless rise. So that's one proposal that's been made. And then some people say, you know, we haven't actually reached the marker yet because our impacts are only going to get greater as our population increases, as our resource use increases. So, you know, hang around and some more obvious marker will present itself.
Hmm. There are other people who say, well, maybe it started with the development of agriculture, which was like 8 or 10,000 years ago. And I'm curious, if that were to be adopted eventually, would we just sort of eliminate the Holocene from our textbooks?
Yeah, that is a theory, a very interesting theory that's been advanced by a scientist named Bill Ruddiman, who's a professor emeritus right now at the University of Virginia. I don't think that is, I mean, it's an interesting theory because his theory is, look, human beings have really been influencing particularly the climate, since the beginning almost the beginning of the Holocene, since we invented agriculture, we cut down a lot of forests, and we changed carbon dioxide levels very slightly, but according to his theory, enough to stave off the beginning of a new ice age. And this is a, you know, very interesting, but by no means well-accepted theory.
So it won't be like decommissioning Pluto. It's not going to happen over a weekend or something.
Right, and I don't think... I don't think it's sort of in the cards at all. I'm not sure that officially naming the Anthropocene is in the cards, but I don't think that we're going to eliminate the Holocene. I don't think that's going to happen. That's one worry that I wouldn't have.
So let's talk about human population in the last century or so. And you have in the article a sort of formula by which we calculate the impact that we actually have on our environment.
Well, that was a formula developed about, I guess, 30 years ago by a bunch of people, including John Holdren, who's now President Obama's science advisor. And basically the theory there is just, okay, let's, you know, look at how we would try to quantify human impact on the planet. And one variable is clearly simply how many of us there are. But there are other variables, too, and we all sort of know this intuitively, which is, you know, it depends on how many resources you're using, right? So it's often, people often do these calculations, like if everybody lived the way Americans lived, you know, how many planets would we need to provide those resources? And it turns out to be, you know, several, many planets would be needed. Many people are obviously living much much closer to, you know, to the edge of survival, using far fewer resources. So it's not just population, it's also resource use, it's also technology, whether your technologies are very energy intensive or not. So there are other calculations that sort of go into this calculation, and at the end of the day, you get this, you know, very rough idea of, you know, sort of what our impacts are.
But when you multiply population by those other factors, it really does quickly spiral. So it's not simply a matter of how many of us there are.
Right. I mean, it's quickly spiraling for both of those reasons, both because, or for two major reasons, both because our population is continuing to increase. We are going to hit 7 billion this year or very early next year. So, you know, it only took us about a dozen years to add another billion people. And it's also increasing because people around the world are increasingly, you know, really living like we're living, eating more meat, using more fossil fuels. And so both of those figures are increasing.
The other interesting thing about the formula is that population and affluence are multiplied by technology. A lot of people, when they think about the threats that are against us and the things we have to deal with, almost would look at technology as something you would use to divide the other two things by, because somehow our technology makes us more efficient.
Right. Well, that could be true. I mean, I don't want to. That's not impossible. It's not impossible according to the sort of logic of the formula.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't happen to be true for the most part right now, because our use of technology is by and large based on energy, which is by and large coming from fossil fuels. So it's really just a way that we are, in effect, just another form of consumption. How's that?
So human population, we've been wrong before in trying to calculate what it would be at a particular time, but most experts seem to agree now that it will top out somewhere around the middle of this century. Could that moment be the time from which we date the Anthropocene? Could that be the event?
Well, you know, once again, just from a perspective, looking at it from a strictly sort of geological perspective, that would be a weird. I mean, you could just choose a date. You could just say, okay, you know, 1800. Some people have proposed that. Let's just choose the date 1800.
Start of the Industrial Revolution.
Right. And, but, you know, if you're looking at it from the perspective of the geological record, 1800 isn't going to leave a record, and 2050 isn't going to leave a record.
Yeah.
And, you know, population topping out isn't going to leave a record. So you're looking for some kind of either chemical signature or sedimentary signature that you're going to find, you know, that theoretically would still be there, you know, 100 million years from now, the same way we look back, you know, at the Jurassic or whatever and say, okay, that's still there.
So do geologists have a lot of thought on whether or not we can amend or correct some of the damage that we've already caused without limiting the ability of people who live in what we would now consider substandard conditions in many parts of the world to continue to progress and maybe gain middle-class status? Is it possible to have both?
Well, I guess I'm going to... I don't like to sort of speak for on geologists, how's that, not being one.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think geologists consider that their territory, to be frank. I mean, their territory is looking at the record of the past, and also, you know, trying to, some would say, trying to sort of look at what we're doing to the planet on a geological scale right now. I don't think they'd say my job is to sort of figure out how people are going to, you know, figure out a way out of this sort of needing several planets to provide our needs problem. But I think if you ask, you know, a lot of people in other fields who are, you know, many, many people obviously actively looking at this question, and I don't think anyone has a sort of easy answer to that. I think everyone, you know, agrees that, well, I don't want to say everyone agrees, but there's very broad agreement, and it's enshrined in many UN treaties that we as the U.S. are signatories to, that, you know, everyone should be able to aspire to the kind of material well-being, you know, that we enjoy in this country and in much of Europe and what we, you know, sort of call the first world. And at the same time that, you know, preserving the planet as we know it is also crucial and something that we, you know, sort of all agree on, and how you reconcile those two, if you can reconcile those two, you know, wow, that is truly, and, you know, once again, I'm going to give you my opinion as opposed to geologists' opinion, mm-hmm. that is the question of our century. That really is the question of our century. Can those two things be reconciled? And my answer, once again, is that's not clear.
Is the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere at any one time easily discovered within the layers of rock, or is that something that scientists simply have to estimate based on the other evidence that does appear?
Yeah, the only thing that you can tell, and this gets a little bit complicated, is you can tell the ratio of different kinds of carbon.
Mm-hmm.
So carbon comes in different forms depending on its atomic weight, depending on what's in the nucleus of the atom, and that can sort of tell you whether there's been a big release of organic carbon, and fossil fuels, for example, are just, you know, organic carbon that's been around for a really, really long time. And sometimes in the geological past, we do see these big releases of carbon that we can't explain necessarily, and then we can look at, okay, what seems to have happened to the global temperatures after that, and, you know, yes, almost, you know, invariably we do see big warming effects coming after that, but it's...
I'm going to have to stop you. I'm so sorry. We have a quick break to take.
Sure.
Elizabeth Colbert is my guest. Her article in National Geographic is called Age of Man. Join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You are listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Elizabeth Colbert. Her article in the March issue of National Geographic magazine is called Age of Man, Enter the Anthropocene. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can send an email to think@kera.org, or you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. So before the break, Betsy, you were explaining that in terms of measuring in the future the amount of carbon dioxide we might have in the air right now, it's a matter of ratios.
Well, right, you can't get a direct measurement. You can measure these ratios, but, you know, people have developed. I should also add, and, you know, this also gets kind of technical, and to be honest, sort of outside my own expertise. But people have developed ways of trying to infer carbon dioxide levels by looking at all sorts of different things, including, for example, you know, plants take up CO2, and when there's a lot of CO2 in the air, they have littler, you know, openings to do that. And then in the times when there's, you know, less, sort of plant openings become bigger, and so you can look at plant fossils. So there are all sorts of ways that people have devised for trying to get a handle on this issue, some of them chemical, some of them looking at the fossil record. And once again, you know, people have a pretty good idea going back, you know, quite a long ways now, 100 million years or so. But as I mentioned before, there are pretty big error bars in that.
What sort of evidence is likely to be obvious in terms of the way that we not only use water but divert natural waterways? Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, you know, once again, it's like sort of what who are you imagining the geologists of the future to be? Are they, you know, super clever, you know, aliens, or what are they? But if they are super clever aliens and they look at patterns of things like, you know, one of the big records that you get of the past is in sedimentary rocks and places where there's been a lot of silting, right? So a river delta or something like that, you know, show up as a very large layer of sedimentary rock later on. Now, one of the things that we've done is we've really changed those patterns very much. In some places, we've, you know, cut down forests and tremendously increased the rate of silting. And in some places, like, for example, the Mississippi Delta, where there used to be a lot of sediment running down the Mississippi River, and that that the whole delta is obviously built of that, and that is why, you know, New Orleans is where it is. But now we've sort of starved that area of that sediment, which would drop out of the river as the river hit the sea. And so you have this problem right now in New Orleans, for example, that the city is sinking.
Mm-hmm.
So if you were clever and you could look at that, you'd say, okay, well, something came here and changed these longstanding patterns.
And I would imagine one thing that is relatively easy to measure is sea level, right? The depth of the sea?
Yeah, I mean, you can look at you know, the rocks and where things are clearly, you know, fossilized marine organisms. And you can, you know, once again, there are many different ways we're trying to map out where sea levels were and where seas were. And once again, the continents have drifted. The whole world is very, very, very different, you know, from what it was in the geological past. And once again, scientists have spent, you know, many, many years and many millions of dollars trying to do this, and we have a pretty good idea of what the world looked like at, if you took a snapshot at various points in time, what sea level was like, and where the continents were relative to each other.
The other interesting thing about the modern era is that we have used up, you know, billions of years of natural resources that have built up over time within a couple of hundreds of years. Will that be evident? Is there a way to measure that?
Well, that's sort of the heart of the matter, as you point out. I mean, when we burn fossil fuels, what we're doing is we're taking carbon, plant life that did not completely decompose, and that still has a lot of energy left in it, and that took literally hundreds of millions of years. So our coal deposits, our oil deposits, took many millions of years to collect, and that carbon was, you know, sequestered away from the atmosphere for all that time, and we are in a matter of centuries going to put it all into the atmosphere. And that is what is going to cause some of these markers that are going to be legible in the record for a long time. And that's what's causing climate change, and that's what's causing ocean acidification, and that's what's going to cause something that's called a carbon isotope excursion, a change in the kind of ratio of the carbon in the air. So all of these things, a very, you know, pretty clear signals will be left by our use of fossil fuels.
Are there any, to your mind, really convincing arguments against calling this modern time, whenever we decide it starts, the Anthropocene?
Well, I mean, I suppose I'm not a geologist, has that, so I suppose people will argue, you know, show me exactly how this is comparable. You know, show me the organism, let's say, or the fossil that's, you know, that we're not going to find, or that we are going to find, that makes us comparable to other times in geological history. But I think that, you know, a lot of geologists, and sort of almost a surprising number of geologists, because, as I say, geologists are quite conservative in that sense, think there is a compelling case to be made. But as is also, there are geologists who say, look, you know, that we just don't know. When you're living through a moment, you know, geology looks at things many, many years after the fact, and we just don't know what the impact of this is going to be yet.
And I guess the real reason for changing the name, it's not going to, you know, a nomenclature change is not going to change anything, but the idea is that this is a really severe warning.
Yes, exactly. And I think that, you know, the people who are most deeply involved in this, starting with Paul Crutzen, would say, yes, this is a wake-up call. This is a teaching tool. And what we're trying to impress on people is that we are a geological force. People are sort of, it's sort of an interesting development in science that a lot of the scientific discoveries of the last century or two have tended to put people in their place. You know, we're just another animal. We have evolved over time, just like all other animals from other hominids. We live on a planet that it's just like any other planet and revolves around the sun. It doesn't, the sun doesn't revolve around the Earth. And one of the things that people point to is that it turns out that people are really quite extraordinary. They do have these radical differences from other animals, one of which being they can change, the planet on this geological scale, and they can drive a lot of other organisms into extinction, and that we need to be cognizant of that and in some sense take responsibility for that. And until we're aware of that, that's not going to happen.
I'm really interested in your process in writing about science, in how you, first of all, simply keep up with the developments that are going on. I mean, obviously, you're at conferences and you're traveling around the world. What do you read, and where do you go to sort of continue to inform yourself about the things you're going to choose to write about?
Well, as as a reporter, one of the great parts about the job is you can just call people up and
they'll talk to you.
Right, exactly, and they'll talk to you. And most people are pretty interested in trying to share their work. A lot of this scientific work is, all of it's obviously published in scientific publications. A lot of it's pretty hard, pretty inaccessible to a lay audience, in which I definitely include myself. And so I often just call people up and go visit them in their labs, and have been very, very generous with their time in walking me through it. And they're also, if people are interested in keeping up with the latest news out of science, there's a lot of good websites that I recommend. There's something called Science Daily, which just posts really the latest studies that have come out and does a pretty good job of translating them for a general audience.
Have you seen a change over the course of your career in the interest of working scientists to try to communicate with lay people as opposed to simply sort of staying in the lab and speaking only to people who already know what they're talking about?
Well, I think in terms of people who are working on issues of what's very broadly called global change these days, the ways in which people are changing the planet are really alarm. They see that when you go back, exactly the issues that we've talked about, when you go back over the geological record, you cannot find analogs for what we're doing. You cannot find, it's unclear whether there's any moment in geological history where, for example, ocean chemistry has changed as quickly as it's changing now, and that is a very ominous thing to be happening. And so that they do want to get that message out to people before it's too late.
It's a strange time in human history, too, in that never before have we been sort of on the brink of global disaster and known it was coming.
Yeah, that's really one of the great, ironies of all these predictive sciences and, ironies or tragedies or whatever you want to say. We have more information than ever before, and yet you can argue we are ignoring it more thoroughly than ever before. That's certainly true, I think, of the climate science, which is really, I think, very powerful and very compelling and just on scientific grounds.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Reeves on the line in Dallas. Hi, Reeves.
Hi. I want to applaud Elizabeth Colbert for all the writing, wonderful writing that she's done. I'm in Dallas, and Dallas Morning News, after she had the article in New Yorker some years ago, and I believe the book following, that said, well, she's not a scientist, but, there is a place for the science writer in our community, the layperson that can translate all this information for the rest of us. And I'm just also wondering why people don't do more things on a personal level. I know I've called in many times about the lawn care industry and how I find that objectionable. Well, I hired three wonderful fellows from Mexico to come help me. And we spent the time for 5 hours working in the garden, and we all had a great time. I worked with them. And I think that people need to think about idling their engines and whether or not that's a good idea, which it's not, and also going back to some of the low-tech ways of gardening, for example.
Rich, thanks so much for your call. Elizabeth, how do you feel about that, the idea that, you know, sometimes it seems as if only sort of massive united change will make a difference. Other times it really feels important to us as individuals to do what we can do on a personal sort of household level.
Well, that's a really interesting issue that you and that your caller, you know, have touched on. And I think, once again, I think both are true. I mean, I think that people can, if everyone took action on his or her own or his or her household or family, it would make a difference. On the other hand, you know, it's true that unless it's globalized on a certain level, you know, it doesn't make a tremendous amount of difference to the global situation. But I guess I think that things that are worth doing, and they're worth doing even if they're not globalized right now, and maybe eventually they will be, and maybe showing other people by example is a very useful thing to do. So I certainly applaud and encourage people to do that. But I also think, you know, it is true when people say, look, everyone, you know, changing one light bulb or whatever isn't going to do it. That is also true. So both are true.
On the whole, do you find the scientists that you work with and interview are optimists about the future? Are they pessimists? Are they neutral?
That's a good question. They are, you know, once again, people, it's sort of one of the, I think, precepts of being a scientist is, right, you know, we try to look at the facts. And the facts as they are right now, I think many of them would say are very, very ominous, but I don't think that they would go so far as to say I'm optimistic. Most of them, I'm, you know, so obviously personally they have their own opinions, but, you know, their work isn't in whether we're going to be able to solve these things or not. Many of these problems, you know, probably could be dealt with if, once again, we put our collective will to work here. But I think increasingly, you know, people who work in these fields are alarmed and perhaps discouraged because they see that time is slipping away.
Elizabeth Colbert's report in the new issue of National Geographic magazine, the March issue, is called Age of Man, Entered the Anthropocene. Betsy, it's always a pleasure to have you on. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.